ceremony to dedicate Athens Lancaster FM 159 to the memory and honor of Squadron Leader Ian Wilby Basil Jett, who won the Victoria Cross. And we have, as our special guests here this afternoon, very special guests, Ian's sister, Ethel Broderick, and her daughter, Marion Hildebrand. And they have come as far afield as Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, and New York?
Morrisville, New York.
To be with us and share this event, which is special for everyone concerned here. And this goes back a long ways for you, Ethel, right to the beginning, as early as you can go. We know little about Ian's early life in Alberta, and if perhaps we start with your early years together here with your family, maybe you could tell us the story of how you ended up in the United Kingdom.
Well, my father, of course, was English. He joined up with the Canadian Army, and shortly after he came back from the war, in not very good condition, we moved to Calgary. And there, my brother, Ian, was born. I was then six. No, I was four, I'm sorry, when Will was born. But I do remember that very clearly, the joy I felt of having a younger brother. And, well, just from the beginning, we were such great friends.
Sometimes a rare quality you find between brother and sister, whose tendency is to bicker like I did mine.
No, it was a joy for me. And then when I was 6 years old, we moved to Toronto. My father then was considered a little better. He had been in a military hospital. But we lived in Toronto for about three and a half years perhaps. By which time my father's health had really deteriorated again, and he wanted to get back to England, his homeland, his family, his mother. And so he took all of us to England, where we were all educated, three of us. And Ian, my brother, and I remained the greatest friends. And he was just wonderful with all ages of people. I always remember we used to go out to tea to various friends and the grown-ups, the mothers. Will, or Ian, we called him Will, would just sit there having a conversation with them, keeping them all highly entertained, and dragging out all the skeletons, if any, of course. And it's the way he was. He always got along extremely well with all people. And was always a lot of fun to be around. And we went to school there, all of us. And then they come 1938, of course, and talk of the war, and Chamberlain going over to get his famous Peace in Our Time paper. They were talking of conscripting young people, and at that time, Ian was about to be 20. The conscript age was 20. And he went and more or less pushed to be taken in. He felt that it was to be for 6 months that they were conscripted. And he rather pushed to get in, although I think it wasn't quite his birthday yet. But he got in with the first batch of conscripts and went marching off. We watched them go off.
Whereabouts were you living at the time in the UK?
We were living in Maldon at that time, Surrey, England, which is also southwest of London.
So he was accepted?
He was accepted, yes, and off he went, in the army, of course, and was assigned to the Royal Artillery, and see. And he, I remember he wrote us some very amusing letters because they had to be on guard at various stations on the west coast of England. And of course they were given rifles but no ammunition.
Thankfully. Don't hand a rifle to a young lad.
So anyway, he was in the Royal Artillery for, I really forget how long, and then they were calling for volunteers for the Air Force. And he volunteered, and as I told you, he wasn't quite sure about his being accepted, but if he was to be accepted, he was going to send me a telegram just with the word yes in it, and I was then to let my parents know. Will didn't want to face telling them in case they were terribly upset that he was going into the Air Force. But however, they took it very well. And that was the beginning of his career with the Air Force. He got the DFC not too long afterwards.
Yes, we know that he served his first tour of operations at Mildenhall with No. 15 Squadron, flying Wellington.
Flying Wellington, see.
He won the DFC on a low-level attack on Milan in 1943. We'd like to find out some of Ian's characteristics, and we'd like to build a personality profile such as can be. We have a personality profile such as the activities of the crew would permit. It's either serious operations or ballyhooing around the pubs on leave.
Right.
But that's two-dimensional. We would like to know more about some of his personality characteristics and his special qualities as you knew and loved.
Well, he was a wonderful brother and a very good friend. We had a lot of fun together. And the whole family. Will was always ready to see the funny side of things. And but he also had very serious side. He was very, I suppose one could say, intellectual. And he was particularly keen about classical music, although he'd never been taught music or had any lessons. He had a wonderful feel for it and just got together a tremendous collection of records, and we used to call them concerts, you know, playing these wonderful things. And in fact, he entered various competitions and won them, and, you know, was given Compton Mackenzie, I think, you may know that name or not, but anyway, he was at the head of one of these competitions, and Will won it and was given records, I suppose. But that was one of the things that he was awfully keen about, very keen about gardening. He planted all the roses in my mother's garden and was always terribly interested to see how they were doing when he came on leave. And then I understand that he had a Bible beside his bed all the time. He was in the Air Force and read the Bible from one end to the other, I was told. And
the boys on the crew noted a lot of times that he always loved when he, as you say, liked to see the humorous side of things, and he had a great sense of humor.
He did.
And that helped keep them more buoyant.
Quite.
And they had a great respect for him as crew, and they felt, as they told me earlier, that they had a great sense of crew unity. And that was an extremely important quality amongst crews.
Indeed, yes.
And group captain Mahaddy, Hamish, went to great lengths in his training program to ensure that the crews chose themselves so that they could match themselves personality-wise, as he knew the value of crew integrity in
yes.
the air on ops.
Yes.
And they thought he was quite exceptional at his handling of the crew and his handling of the ground crew. and their sense of unity meant a lot.
Yes.
They often went out together, complete with the ground crew, on Ian's suggestion, well, let's take the ground crew out, let's take the boys out and buy them a beer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, he would do that.
And in Doug Cameron's citation in one of his letters, he mentions that he was thought quite highly of by his ground crew as well, as some of his senior officers and his peers. And that helps make an exceptional person.
I remember when I was with the American 8th Air Force Service Command during the war, as it then was, and we were stationed near Ascot in Surrey. And one morning a plane bomber came over, very low, literally buzzing the camp.
Uh-huh.
And of course I got to the window and I just knew it was Will. But out came the general and all the top officers were all looking out for his aircraft. And then that night, the evening, Will called me and said, did you see me? But it's a wonder they didn't take his number or something, because it was quite wrong what he did, actually. But that was, you know, just his sense of humor, too.
Did you see him much during those years when you were both serving?
Well, always he was home on what leaves he got. He came home. And usually with others, they usually arrived, or he usually arrived quite late, and some of the worst were where, having had a good old time in London before coming home. But yes, we did see quite a bit of them that way.
Were you very far from where you grew up at your respective
in England?
Yes.
Well, no, we weren't. We lived in Wimbledon for many, many years. And then, as just before, you know, Will went into the army and so on, we lived in New Malden, Surrey, which was only a matter of a few miles.
So it was fairly easy to get home.
Yes, well, Will would arrive, you know, at Waterloo Station and take the little electric train down to Malden. And that was quite an easy trip.
Did he drive a car at all?
I don't think so. He may have, you know, I don't know whether he drove, you know, when he was away from home at the station, now what do you call them?
Airfield.
I don't know whether he drove or not. Never at home.
Some people remark with alacrity that here are these young boys, 19, 20, 22, flying these huge aircraft.
Yeah.
And not having their own driver's license.
True.
Interesting.
You know, incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, it is quite an incredible thought.
Yeah, yes, indeed.
As his wireless operator mentioned, he had a motorcycle, and he was the only one on their squad that had a motorcycle, and tore around on it quite frequently.
Yeah.
And of course, you'd be a big shot if you had your own motorcycle.
I wonder if he took any passengers on the back.
Probably did if he hasn't. He probably shouldn't a few times too.
Right.
Can you tell us anything about his personality that was noticeably unique to you, or perhaps was commented upon by other members of your family or your parents? Seemed to be outstanding.
Well, he sort of exuded a sense of strength, so that he was the sort of person that, you know, you would talk to about anything or anything that was troubling you, and just review whatever it was and come up with reassurance or encouragement or whatever was needed, really.
So he had good communication skills?
Very definitely.
Mm-hmm. That makes a big difference, mm-hmm. whether you're talking to your sister or your buddies.
Right.
Or your CEO.
Yes.
Can you recall the last time we saw each other?
Yes, I can. It was his last leave. It was at the time that they were, the Germans were sending a lot of flying bombs over England. In fact, they had just started sort of mass raids of flying bombs. And Will was on leave and, of course, was terribly interested to see this, experience it, because, of course, he had only seen things from the air. And he was quite amazed and appalled, really, at these innumerable flying bombs coming over the engines, quitting and then diving, you know. And as in fact, so many were coming over this last night that I remember him, that my mother and father went into their shelter, which was called a Morrison table, I think they called them in those days. It was a sort of steel thing you put over your dining room table. And then we also had a mattress which we dragged into the hallway, a sort of foyer hallway. And so Will and I decided this was where we'd better be when the bombs were coming too frequently. And I remember asking Will, well, now, which end should I be of this mattress? Which end are you going to be? And he said, well, you better be that end, jokingly, of course, because he said, if the door gets blown in, it'll catch you. He was off the other end.
Sounds like something a brother would say.
Yes. So that was really the last memory I have of him. He went back, and it wasn't long after that, the raid. And the thing that struck me, too, of course, was that the raid at which his plane was set on fire and so on, and the others injured, they were bombing the flying bomb sites at Torcy-Saint-Maximin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it seemed a connection, because mm-hmm. this was the last time I saw him when these flying bombs were raiding us.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Mm-hmm. How did you receive news of the mishap?
Well, I was then working with the Americans, and as I was coming home one night, I was living at home then. We were stationed not too far away. As I rounded the corner to Sycamore Grove, where we lived, I saw the bicycle of a postal delivery person, and it just went through me that this was a telegram telling us something had happened. Sure enough, I got in, and of course my mother and father were in a terrible state, and the telegram, of course, simply stated that he was missing in action at that time. And of course my father proceeded to make many phone calls, and eventually we heard, of course, that it was Will had lost his life, and several of the crew had bailed out. And then not long after that, in September, the American Air Service Command decided to take about 20 British civilians across with them, and we were provided with British officers' uniform in case we were captured. And it was when I was with them and in France, was I in France or Luxembourg then? We moved on to Luxembourg, and it was announced by the BBC that he was being given the Victoria Cross posthumously.
Yes.
And they had phoned from London, the offices of the Air Force Service Command in London had phoned that this was going to be on the BBC that night, and to be sure to get me there to listen in, which I did, and then they acquired several newspapers with the story the next day. And that's how I heard. And then, of course, I heard that George Turner, and I thought one of the other crew members had gone to visit my parents and tell them about it.
Yeah, they probably would be pretty good about that.
Yeah, I know George did, and I thought it was somebody else, but he wasn't sure about that.
Chuck Godfrey sent us in his letter a copy of a letter sent to you that was read by the mayor of Sinan at the service held there on the 8th of October, 44.
Right.
And, was the service somber or peaceful, or can you recall much about the service as you were there, and the welcome you received from the people of Sinan?
Oh, tremendous welcome. It was of course a burial service, and it was attended by veterans of the First War, French veterans of the First War, and there were representatives from the current war, French Army officers, and of course the American, quite a few of our men came, and it was a Catholic service, and of course they had given this piece of ground just in front of the church where he could be buried, and it was a very nice service, I must say. But the French people had come walking, carrying flowers from miles and miles around. We passed them walking towards the Sinan, the little village, when we were coming in from where we were stationed. And it was a really moving sight to see these roads just covered with French people who didn't know him or anything, but knew that he had managed to avoid this little village and so on.
They felt pretty strongly, I think, about the men who were trying to free them.
Oh yes, I think so.
And the Maquis did a great deal for the surviving crew.
Yes.
To save them.
Right. And he had hoped so much to save the other two men. But of course the plane had been all on fire and there was only one engine and exploded on landing.
The fuselage was full of fuel that had washed into the inside from the wing that had been ruptured by the flak.
Yes.
And as soon as he started to skid on the ground, it caught and blew up.
Mm-hmm.
Did the people take you to the crash site or take you to the other doors?
They took us out about a week before the funeral. It was the first time we had gone out there to sort of we'll just go and visit and see, you know, if we could find out anything that had happened. And at that time, when we went, the French told us that they had managed to take my brother's remains and hide them in a cave from the Germans. But the Germans had picked up the other two crew members who were killed in the explosion, who had been unconscious. And they were buried in the military cemetery at Beauvais. And then they told us they were having a service on October the 8th, the following week, and hoped we would come. And indeed we did. But when we went out to the site that first time, the first time we were out there, it was just amazing, and I can sort of see it now because, of course, the plane bits were scattered everywhere. But all scattered amongst it on this hillside were these purple crocuses, I thought they were. And I think they were, and I think it was the heat of the explosion that brought them up. It was just amazing to see.
It's remarkable.
Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful sight.
Flowers seem to have a special quality about them, and
well, with Will's interest in flowers and so on, it was just
it was
lovely that it was there.
A very remarkable connection with him, with flowers, and with flowers having those certain qualities about them en masse.
Right.
I had an experience in my travels in the mountains not long ago where I saw acres and acres and acres of glacier break. Mm-hmm. Glacier lilies high up in an alpine meadow, and it was extraordinary.
Beautiful.
And the experience of seeing masses of flowers like that has a certain uplifting effect on one's spirit.
Indeed.
And the connections there with Ian, Will, are significantly. Magical, almost, even.
Yes, no, it was. Magical is the word. It was quite, well, both moving and just giving Mom a wonderful feeling that this had happened for him.
Peace
almost. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you were there at the right time, and that...
That was a wonderful thing, too.
A little gift from the good Lord at the right time.
Absolutely, yes. Yes.
Much appreciated.
I was grateful. My parents were grateful, of course. I was able to write and describe the whole thing to them. And the Americans were wonderful, wonderfully helpful at that time. And, of course, had an interpreter along. But the schoolmaster and his wife, who had evacuated out to there from where they lived, which was nearer the German border, and they were there with their little family, and they were wonderful to the crew members who had bailed out. And very wonderful. In fact, we kept up Christmas cards with Madame Lalouet until she died not too long ago.
Do you have any other special memories of Will that you can share with us?
Can you think of anything I've told you?
My
mind is starting to blink out.
I'm finding out things right now that I hadn't heard before. This is very interesting for me, too.
How did you were his niece, is that right, Marion?
Mm-hmm.
Did you know him at all?
No, never met him. He's just always been... I feel as though I know him because I know how close Mother and he were, and her family memories of him, just nothing remarkable to tell, but just they obviously had so much fun together, and visits they would make to different places and different relatives and so on. Mother's recollections would always be colored by recalling how Will had made some kind of fun happen during those occasions.
We used to go on vacations in Ireland, because Mother was born in Ireland, and Will came along. I guess it was the last one before the war, and this is the time of Chamberlain, they say, came back with his famous piece of paper. And, oh, we had so much fun. Will just loved it over there in Ireland, too. We just met a nice family, whom we're still friendly, still in touch. And had a great time. He was just so full of fun and keeping everybody laughing. And yet, you know, he could sit down and talk to the older people, and they just loved it. Always had that ability to really start talking away to the older people so they didn't feel left out, and, you know, it's just great.
Maybe you could relate to some of your own activities, any within the war at the time. You mentioned you served with the American 8th, and that was in a U.S. intelligence unit?
Yes.
Is that right?
1942 I went with them. I had been with a bank in London, Lloyd's Foreign Bank, and they had been headquartered in France, but with the invasion, they came over to England and set up shop in London. And I was working as secretary with them, and that was an exempt job. But I had a friend who was going with the American Air Force, 8th Air Force, as it then was when we went abroad. When we went to France, it became the 9th Air Force Service Command. But this friend was very anxious for me to start working for the Americans as well. And but I had to get special permission from my boss, the bank, because we were exempt. But I told him I wanted to do something more active with the war. And so he was good enough to release me. And then we were stationed in Bushy Park, which wasn't far from my home in Surrey. And then, of course, with D-Day and the invasion, we were to be the third echelon going over into France, and they had decided, as I say, to bring, I think there were 20 civilians. And so I was awfully glad to go, because I knew then possibly I could visit my brother's plane crashed and landed, I should say, and exploded. And so that's, previous to that, of course, I was in London for the Blitz. And,
did you end up scurrying down the tube station very often?
On several occasions, yes, and had the most extraordinary journeys to get back up to the offices in London because some part of the train had been bombed or something, and they had shuttle buses running, and we had to walk so far, and had various ways of getting up there. And of course, the English, who were a little bit aloof at times, became so friendly then you'd find yourself talking to whoever was near you, which was unusual for England at that time. But then came, of course, the firebombs on London, which was an astounding sight at night, of course. I mean, you just thought the whole of London was burning as you looked at it in the suburbs.
I have a memory of a picture of St. Paul's.
Oh, yes.
And it had been bombed all around it.
Mm-hmm.
A magnificent cathedral, and was on fire all around it.
Yep.
And the cathedral,
yeah,
scarcely got scratched.
Yes.
And I can remember seeing, yeah, a photograph of the, yeah, huge fires all around it.
Yes, well, I worked at that time not far from St. Paul's, in the city itself. You know, there's one square mile, which was always called the city in London. And where, you know, the Bank of England was and so on. And I can remember walking, having got as far as I could, and walking, and the firemen were all working, you know, on the fires all down the, I think it was Victoria Street or something, I've forgotten the name of it. But, and I remember seeing a whole wall just sort of collapsing down, you know, and everything was roped off. Of course, another thing at that time was the, what they called the late action bombs, which the Germans used to drop all over the place. And then you'd see places roped off and the demolition crews going in to try to get hold of this bomb before it would go off. Which took a lot of doing, I think.
A lot of nerve to be on that.
Right. It really did.
Just as it takes a lot of nerve for the modern day exponents of those wartime diffusers to go in sniffing out IRA bombs.
I know, oh yes. It's too bad. It has to be like that.
What have you done? You must have moved to the United States after your stint with intelligence was over. What have you done since the war?
Well, I met my husband, of course, in France. He was also with the intelligence. And then from France we moved to Luxembourg and then into Germany. And when we were in France was the time of the Battle of the Bulge, which was rather a sticky moment. Mm-hmm. I remember we were all requested to wear red hats, top hat, helmets, you know, what do you call it? Helmets, hard hats, anyway, wherever we were, we told to wear these things. I suppose the Germans were supposed to appear on our doorstep any moment. But however, we then moved into Luxembourg, which is a lovely little country. Delightful. And we were billeted right by the Luxembourg Palace, where the royal family used to watch their comings and goings from the back door, as it were. And then we moved into Germany. And we used to all move in these little planes, you know, we sat all in, you know, seats all along one side of the plane. And on awful airfields that had been bombed, and they had stretched sort of mesh over the airfield to, you know, help catch the planes that came in. It was rather air-raising measure.
It was.
And then we were in Germany until VE Day, was it called? Mm-hmm. Victory Day?
You sounded like you were fairly close to all the hot action there.
What was left of it, yes. Not far away from it, but you know, by the time we were there, really things had calmed down considerably.
Did it seem like a hair-raising experience to you, or did you take it all in your stride?
No, it didn't seem particularly hair-raising. Of course, we had had the Blitz, and this was extremely calm compared with that. So we were, took it all in stride, yes. In fact, we used to get hold of bicycles through the headquarters and go cycling all over the place as much as we could, see things. And then I decided to leave. It was time, you know, the war was over and so on, to go back to England. And then my husband went back to the States very shortly after that, but he wasn't my husband then. And then called me on the transatlantic telephone, popping the question again. He was always popping it when we were there. He used to say, "Shall I ask Father Gaffney to get out the gear?" I said, "No, not yet." But anyway, of course, he left, he went back. Meanwhile, I was working for the British Consul in London. And then when he called me, I did at that time say yes. And we were married in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And the children were all born in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
When you say you take all these things in stride, it reflects back onto something Chuck Godfrey told me. And here's something that will parallel your mom and Ian. One of the things they told me about Ian was that in some of their sticky moments or shaky do's, he was extremely calm and took things in his stride. And,
yes.
I can see your mother relates that story that she did the same.
It did sound that way.
And there's a parallel there. Mm-hmm. I think I should make mention of it.
Well, at the time, of course, there were really no alternatives, really, to the way you could take things. You know what I mean? I mean, this was happening, and...
It's easier when you're young.
You had it. Oh, much. Yes, I'd hate to have to go through it again now, I must say. But,
So you spent the rest of your years living happily in Pennsylvania?
Reasonably happily, yes. I didn't go back to England for 17 years. At that time, I took Marion, who was 14 months old. That was the first time I did get back in all those years. Because my husband actually was, first of all, when we first married, he was teaching at the University of Notre Dame. And then he was approached by some magazines in New York. He was a writer. If he'd like to come, of course, that was his dearest love. He was very happy to go and write for them and be a part of their stuff. The one was the Commonweal, the Catholic lay magazine, and the other was the New Yorker magazine. And not long after that, his war feelings began to catch up with him, and he had some problems, neurological, and spent some time in veterans' hospitals, and has been, you know, at home but out of the picture in that way ever since.
A number of veterans have been plagued in later years with nightmares and other associations as those memories well up from deep within the subconscious, mm-hmm. where they went almost straight away, as there was too much going on and mm-hmm. you had to be too sharp on your job to worry a lot about it.
Yeah.
They do come back mm-hmm. later.
Right.
Have you been back to Sanaa very often?
No, I went back once, and my to-be husband came with me. He spoke French beautifully, fluently, and was just grand to have along. And we went back then, and where did we go back from? Germany, I think. Drove back in a command car and were able to stay the night with a friend we had made in near Cray, where we were stationed. She had done a lot of interpreting, this friend, too, for the Americans, and done a lot of good work, and she used to hide things up her chimney from the Germans. She was a very interesting person. And anyway, I went back that time. So all told, I suppose I was in Sonata about three times altogether, counting for the funeral and beforehand and then that subsequent visit.
Fascinating story, Ethel. Mm-hmm. I'm glad, really glad you came here to share it.
I'm awfully grateful to be invited and also for what the Nanton Lancaster Society is, the way they are honoring my brother. Very grateful for that.
There were a lot of special people in the war, a lot of unsung heroes that came and went. And Ian was one who received his honor for his bravery, for his ultimate sacrifice.
Right.
And there are so many who will never be known.
Exactly.
Going down in their aircraft on fire.
Yes.
Did whatever it was until the very end.
Right.
Trying to make it right.
Yes. Indeed, yes. Unsung heroes.
I like to think that all is not lost. And if the Bible story of the resurrection has any credence, and I believe it does, then all is not lost. Shall all meet again.
Right. That's my dearest hope, too.
Onwards and upwards. So, on the flip side of it, we'll see all our lost love once again. Yours and I might.
Wouldn't it be wonderful, yes. I sometimes get a strange feeling, as I've said to Marion, that Will is up there somehow witnessing all this, you know, and getting quite a kick out of it, finding something funny to say about this tremendous gathering, you know.
Funny you should mention that, because yesterday, early in the morning, before I had arisen, and just as I was going to bed, I had the same feeling.
Did you really?
Yeah. There's a certain presence.
Uh-huh. Well, that's what it is. I've mentioned that to Marion several times, and I just know it is so.
So, we're right on that. Yeah. Flowers, you know?
Yeah.
It's that, in a way. I think we're done, Harv.